You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm Zainab Nawaz, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the International Women's Program here at the Open Society Institute. We're really pleased you could all join us for lunch today, and we're planning on having the session run till about 3. Before I turn over the session to Bukeni Wazuri from Witness, I just wanted to gently remind everyone to please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries, or at least put them on vibrate. So with that, I will turn it over to Bukeni. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. First of all, thank you so much, Zainab, and especially the International Women's Program of OSI for hosting this event, and also most importantly for feeding us. Today, actually, we'll talk about the issue of violence against women in Southern Africa. And we are very grateful and lucky to have wonderful experts to, you know, walk us through the issue. And I will give you a kind of, you know, the structure of the event today. First, I think we will see a movie, which is a 15-minute video produced by RAU Research and Advocacy Unit, which is a Zimbabwe-based organization. And after the screening, we will introduce our panelists. We have three of them. One is Mariana from Human Rights Watch, Kelly from ICTJ, and Ms. Kudakwashe from Research and Advocacy Unit. One of our panelists couldn't join us today, which is Mrs. Boto Nduku. She couldn't be with us today because at the DRC mission of at the UN, they had kind of emergencies to talk about, at the UN with the Security Council on the issue of a UN mission in the Congo. So she apologized and she couldn't be with us today. That's why we are missing one of our panelists, as announced in the invite that you received during the last week. So for that, I will ask our colleague Stephanie to turn the video on. I think this film, this video, I'll say, is really heartbreaking. And now I think we're gonna now pass on to our panelists to talk us more about the issue of sexual or violence against women in Southern Africa. And as you may see, in Zimbabwe especially, the issue of sexual violence has had as motive the political motives to as a way to weaken or to make these women, you know, quiet and not able to speak out. And now I think I'm going to turn to my colleague Kudakwashe, who is a Zimbabwean women's rights activist, lawyer, and program manager with the Research and Advocacy Unit, where she documents human rights violations against women, specifically analyzing the political violations and their socioeconomic effect. Prior to join RAU in 2006, Ms. Kudakwashe worked for 9 years in the NGO sector in different capacities on human rights, democracy, and governance issues in Zimbabwe. Ms. Kuda holds an LLB and a master's in international public law from the University of Stellenbosch in Cape Town in South Africa. She will give us an overview of the situation of violence against women in Zimbabwe, and she will tell us a little bit what kind of a solution need to be taken in order to really end the violence against women in Zimbabwe. So Ms. Kuda, you have the floor.
Thank you, Bukeni. I'd like to say thank you to Witness and to OSI for having and organizing this panel. I'm just going to speak a little bit about the Research and Advocacy Unit and the campaign that we are having on violence against women. So the Research and Advocacy Unit has started a campaign to end politically motivated violence against women in Zimbabwe, as the 2008 election period was particularly brutal. Women were beaten, raped, tortured, had their property looted, their houses burnt. Violence is continuing as we speak right now. Women are being beaten and raped, particularly on the farms and on the diamond fields in Chiadzwa. I also just recently got this today that says that in Chiweshe, 50 homes of known MDC supporters were burnt down by the youth militia. The residents were forced to leave their homes and have sought refuge in neighboring areas. Suspected armed Central Intelligence Organization agents tried to abduct an MDC security officer in broad daylight. She fought, and the attackers ran away. And as I said, there's been atrocities on the farms. And as you know, there was a major diplomatic incident with the special rapporteur on torture being deported from Zimbabwe, just to give you a context of the situation that we are working with. So we know that there's always an upsurge of violence during elections, and we want to ensure that this doesn't happen in the next election period. This campaign is in collaboration with the Women's Coalition of Zimbabwe, which is a membership organization of over 40 organizations and hundreds of individual members. We feel that this campaign is of national importance and intends to engage the organ on national healing, which is the organ that was created by the inclusive government to deal with the violence and as a way to for Zimbabwe to move forward. The film that we've just watched is one of the tools that we're using as part of our advocacy strategy for this campaign. So studies have shown that the effects of political conflict in Zimbabwe on women's physical, social, and psychological well-being is massive. And they are not only primary victims, but also secondary victims, as they are caregivers. And in many instances, these women care for the injured, be they their children, their husbands, their brothers, who are involved in politics. Women are being caught up in politics, not because they themselves are politically active, but because their family members are active. Women were targeted in 2008 because their male family members were involved. And when the perpetrators arrived looking for these men and didn't find them, they assaulted the women. Interestingly, it appears to have been a strategy by the political activists that the men would leave their homes seeking refuge somewhere else in the belief that their wives and children wouldn't be targets, but this strategy backfired. Another theory is that when these men left their homes, they asked their families to come with them. But because women are deeply connected to the domestic side of their duties, they refused to leave, as usually the homestead was all they possessed. And also they couldn't leave, because it was not always practical to leave and find a safe haven with three or four children in tow. The perpetrators then attacked the women to punish the absentee men, showing that they believe that women are the property of men. And those women that were beaten in their own right, the message was politics is a male domain and women should not be involved. There is a need for women in Zimbabwe to overcome customary law practices and processes that prevent women from making decisions about their own lives. Sexual violence didn't start in Zimbabwe during the 2008 election period. There is evidence from as far back as the Liberation War in the 1960s. There are women out there who bore children as a result of being abused at the bases set up by the freedom fighters. These women need to be recognized and should not be forgotten when we are dealing with violations of the past. Many women and girls were sexually abused during the June 2008 election period. As you saw, we're talking about 2,000 women raped in a space of 3 months. This is just an estimation because we don't know exactly how many women were abused. because women don't come out in the open. Most of these women are suffering in silence because of the stigma attached to rape, especially in the rural areas, and for fear of retaliation, as the perpetrators are still on the streets. As Memory said, when she went to the police, she was told, "We're not dealing with political cases right now." She sees the man who raped her at the clinic, which means nothing is being done. Other women are afraid to come out because they fear they will lose their marriages and embarrass their families, again showing that women have been raised to put their husbands and families ahead of their own personal needs. The law enforcement system, including the police and the judiciary, is partisan and male-dominated. And changes need to be put in place, as asking these women to come out and demand their rights in an environment that is likely to re-traumatize them is counterproductive. The fact that there are very few women legislators and female judges is a major obstacle in the Zimbabwean scenario. Women feel that they are not well represented in parliament and the judiciary. Thus, it would be difficult for their needs to be addressed. Women need to be educated and empowered with regards to their rights, how to demand their rights, and speak up when these rights have been infringed upon. Sexual violence is a matter that is usually swept under the carpet. There is disbelief and ignorance among members of the community on this issue. Therefore, there's an urgent need to talk about it openly. We screened this video to Agenda and Development Thematic Committee in the Senate. This is the higher house in the Zimbabwean Parliament. And one of the members told us that there's no such thing as gang rape. It doesn't happen. They said men don't behave like that. Men are not animals. So this is the caliber of decision makers that we have to deal with within the Zimbabwean scenario, showing that we have a long way to go. Women are concerned also about the process of truth-telling. And in our consultations, there was a question of whether women would want their issues to be brought before a truth commission, looking at the sensitivities that we've mentioned earlier. It was agreed that the issues should be addressed collectively by society and not only by women for it to be effectively dealt with. Men should also participate because some of them were victims indirectly because their sisters, wives, daughters were raped and suffered other forms of abuse. The Zimbabwean government has signed and ratified instruments protecting women from violence, but very few have been domesticated and implemented. The most recent being the SADC Gender and Development Protocol, which Parliament agreed to ratify just a couple of weeks ago in mid-October. This is one of the instruments that we've been advocating for its ratification, and we're excited that this has happened, but we are concerned by the lack of seriousness that women's issues receive. We know that the parliamentarians only received a copy of the protocol the morning of the meeting, so they didn't have a chance to read it. They just signed and they said, right, we're agreeing to ratify this protocol. It's not a good thing, but it works in our advantage because once the protocol is law, we can push for its implementation as the protocol is very progressive, as it emphasizes redress and justice for victims of gender-based violence. RAO, together with the Women's Coalition, IDASA, and ICTJ are in partnership to conduct a survey on women's issues of transitional justice. The survey is targeted at women of all age groups, all from all political divides and of different educational backgrounds. The ultimate goal is to understand women's needs in relation to peace, justice, democracy, and good governance, as well as to recommend a framework to the Organ on National Healing, informed by the voices of the women gathered through the survey. Our aim is to know what the Zimbabwean women want for themselves and to ensure that their voices are heard. This is our campaign, and we hope we receive support not only within Zimbabwe, but within the region and internationally. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kuda, for that very wonderful presentation, helping us to know what kind of challenges are in Zimbabwe and what women are facing, the link between the elections in Zimbabwe and the violence that happens to women, and also the need to have a clear leadership, the leaders who can understand and willing to implement some transitional justice instruments. Now, this is the picture about Zimbabwe, but this issue, when you look at the big picture, is an issue that is all across Africa, especially in the southern region. It's come, you know, it is in Congo. We know the conflict has been one of the reason why the women have been targeted, and also you have a kind of a massive statistics of women being raped and sexually abused. When you look at the country like Madagascar, where a political crisis has generated massive cases of violence against women. Look at, for example, Tanzania. The lack of, you know, access to resources has also generated the violence against women. Why women are being targeted? Why in any circumstance, in any situation, throughout the region, why these women continue to suffer? So this is a question that Ms. Mariana Molman will try to kind of dig deep, what kind of causes that really, you know, are behind the target, be behind the suffer of the women. Ms. Mariana is the Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, Women's Rights Division. She specializes in reproductive rights, women in conflict, economic rights, and in general, women's rights issue. Formerly, as an America's researcher on women's rights at Human Rights Watch, Ms. Molman moved to Human Rights Watch from Peru, where she worked with Centro de la Mujer Peruana Flora Tristan. I'm sorry.
Very good.
So this and other local NGO there. Ms. Molman is the former co-coordinator of the Women's Working Group of the International Network for Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, and the former executive director of the network in solidarity with the people of Guatemala. Ms. Molman actually speaks Spanish, French, Danish, and maybe more other languages. So, please welcome.
Thank you so much. There are not so many things you need to know about me. Most of them have to do with what I'm not. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm also not American. English is not my first language, and sometimes I find lately that I'm translating more for whatever reason. So if it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about, that's why. I'm looking for the words. I've been asked to talk about why women are targeted for sexual violence and conflicts in southern Africa. And I think that we've already heard the answers. They're not different in different countries. And we've heard the answer has to do with inequality, how women are seen with regard to men. They have to do with impunity, and they have to do with inaction. In Human Rights Watch's research and experience, this is really the same everywhere. Rape or the threat of rape or sexual violence affects all women everywhere. Statistics are not very good, but most women or most girls have a friend or a family member that has been affected by some sort of sexual violence. And certainly every woman and girl that I've ever spoken to knows that sexual violence could affect her, that it could be a reality for her. So in that sense, this is something that affects all of us. The relevant question here is why, and again, there are a few general answers. First of all, national legislation on sexual violence in many places does not reflect the rhetorical condemnation of rape and sexual violence. Anybody you ask will say, yes, sexual violence is bad, yes, rape is bad, but the legislation doesn't reflect this. Often, legislation doesn't criminalize rape between spouses or rape between parents and children even, or the legislation may minimize or very narrowly define what sexual violence is, thus contributing to the impunity and certainly minimizing the seriousness of sexual violence. Secondly, in most countries in the world, women and girls who report rape are questioned, often aggressively, with regard to a lot of things. And this can be politically motivated. Often women are questioned about their sexual past, their clothing at the time of the assault, their general attitude to sex, their number of sexual partners, etc. The woman is, in essence, on trial before she even reports the rape. there seems, in fact, to be only one type of rape that really is seen as bad all the time, and that is the use of rape as a weapon of war. You know, that's where you sort of can get at everybody is saying, yes, this is bad all the time, it really shouldn't happen. And even so, the record on preventing this type of sexual violence is abysmal. Sexual violence targeting women and girls has been a prominent characteristic, and I would say a prominently horrific characteristic of all recent conflicts and not so recent conflicts and post-conflict situations. For example, in a 2005 UN study conducted in areas affected by the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire, respondents ranked fear of sexual violence as a major security problem over extortion, forced labor, threats, killings, and other forms of physical violence. Sexual violence was what they feared the most because it was happening a lot. During the armed conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we've already heard this, tens of thousands of women and girls have been raped and otherwise subjected to sexual violence. And victims, you know, certainly the victims that we've documented have been of an age range. You know, we saw this in the movie, but an age range from, you know, 3 years old till what people would talk about as, you know, somebody's grandmother's age, et cetera. So the problem clearly is everywhere. Human rights and humanitarian organizations have reported sexual violence in Afghanistan, Burundi, Chad, Colombia, Cote d'Ivoire, Liberia, Peru, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Sudan, Chechnya, Uganda, the former Yugoslavia. I'm just, you know, mentioning the ones that we have any research on. I'm sure many of you have researched other places. So largely unreported in the mass, in the general media, are also the daily rapes that are happening right now in the DRC, Chad. You know, Guinea looks like it's a little more settled, but certainly, you know, the recent conflict or recent events, there was a lot of sexual violence. So there is no conflict in recent history where women and girls have not been targeted for sexual violence, whether as a form of torture, as a method to humiliate the enemy, or with a view to spreading terror and despair. There are a number of reasons for the continued use of sexual violence as a weapon of war or in conflict situations. First, because it's effective. And it will be continued to be used as long as it is effective in discouraging the enemy. And it will be effective in discouraging the enemy as long as women are considered subordinate or unequal to men or as appendages to men. Again, we heard how women in Zimbabwe were, you know, probably raped because they were seen as the substitute for the man that had left that community. Well, this is what happens in many places. Women are perceived as attachments to men, and they become a symbol of the enemy's personal property or honor, and their bodies are taken over as territory. And I want to say, as I'm saying this, I did not come out of the traditional feminist movement in my home country, Denmark. I did not work as a feminist activist for many years when I worked in human rights. And so the rhetoric of talking about women as the enemy's territory is foreign to me, and yet this is what we see. This is not, you know, some strange feminist theory or something that we're making up. This is what we document in conflict zones. The second reason that rape is used as a weapon of war is that it's an extension of the sexual violence against women in times of peace. And I think this is also sort of a feminist construct that is very easy to document. Impunity for the perpetrators is the rule rather than the exceptions. This happens both in peace and in wartime. In the first of its kind study on violence against women, sort of globally, the United Nations Secretary General in 2006 reached a very depressing conclusion when he said that to an unacceptable extent, states disregard their obligations on the prevention and punishment of violence against women. So the failure on prevention is clear. We see sexual violence everywhere. It's a serious problem in peacetime as well as war crime. The real issue here is impunity, the failure to prosecute. And I see this also, prosecution can be a prevention effort. You know, when you prosecute, you send the message that this is not okay, that male violence, because it is mostly male violence against women, is not okay. As noted in the Secretary General's report, when the state fails to hold the perpetrators of violence accountable and society explicitly or tacitly condones such violence, impunity not only encourages further abuses, it also gives the message that male violence against women is acceptable and normal. And this obviously happens in conflict. You know, prevention efforts fall short. Perpetrators are often allowed to continue abuse with impunity, and some, in fact, are promoted. And I have a number of examples, but we're running somewhat late, and I'm not going to read out all of them. But suffice it to say that, you know, we have documented examples in Sudan, in the DRC, now also in Sierra Leone, where commanders of troops that have raped are promoted. You know, and this is sending a signal, not only that it's okay to rape, it's like, this is actually a good thing. You know, if you are not preventing the people under your command from raping, then, you know, you could be the real deal. You could get a better job, kind of thing. So I now get to the most interesting point, I guess, of this meeting, how to deal with this somewhat effectively. And again, I'm going to take a broad approach. I'm sorry, not sort of narrow in on one country. First of all, I think that everybody should be clear that what we refer to as women's issues aren't issues only for women. We can't claim we don't know how conflicts develop, when civilians will be targeted for abuse. The patterns of violence against particular groups of civilians, whether it's women or children or groups, other groups that are marginalized because of their ethnicity, for example, these patterns are very accurate, and they're very accurate indicators for the phases of conflict. This can be studied. Rising gender inequality, in fact, in particular, violence directed at women, is a very accurate indicator of conflict surges. Processes of discrimination and dehumanization are very much present well before situations of armed conflict and sort of surge. So when you see the surge in discrimination and dehumanization of women, you can also predict that conflict probably will break out or that there will be more street violence at the very least. Early warning systems should at the very least include credible information about the existing status of women, which is a key indicator of democratic practice altogether. And this is something that can be done. This is sort of the front end of what people talk about as responsibility to protect. We don't have to call it that, but we can talk about gender discrimination as early warning system for rising in conflict. This is actually understanding that is of women's equality as a key security issue that led to the adoption of several Security Council resolutions over the past 2 years, 1820, 1888, 1889. I encourage all of you to read these resolutions. They're actually good fun, not least because it's the first time I think Security Council resolutions talk about state responsibility to debunk myths that fuel sexual violence. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but this is what we're talking about here. We have to debunk the myths of inequality or the myths about women's subordination or role in society that lead to sexual violence. And this is now established as state responsibility, even in a Security Council resolution. The second point I want to make on this, you know, how do we deal with this effectively, is that this broader understanding as gender inequality as a security issue is often lost in the details of each case when we're talking about each country situation. I think this is quite normal. You know, we get very wrapped up in what's happening, the specific case, and this is sort of the reason I'm taking a broader approach. It's not because of a lack of will, but it's just because that's the way advocacy normally works. You know, change is made up of these small building blocks, almost like UN resolution. You take already agreed language, you put a little bit extra on, and, you know, you sort of move something forward very incrementally. And we get barked down in the moving this comma or adding the sentence or making sure that, you know, this can just get passed, whether it's a policy initiative or legislation, et cetera. And even with the best of intentions, sometimes it's hard to step back and think about what it is we're actually trying to do. So to me, this is a central and perhaps the most central point that we here as advocates for women and against sexual violence need to remember. Whenever we're advocating for policy development, resolution, declaration, implementation of them, et cetera, we must remember what really is at stake. It's not the piece of paper. It's not the implementation of whatever. It is the broader issue of women's equality, because that's where sexual violence really comes from. I'm going to stop there.
Thank you so much. My mic actually is slipping a little bit. Okay. Thank you so much, Ms. Mollman, for walking us through the lack of prevention that also is explained by, you know, the failure in the prosecution. And as you may know, in countries not just the one you just named, but also in the Congo, we have seen governing authorities not really clear whether to kind of to prioritize peace over justice. You have those former rebels who have been promoted, and then they are the ones who are in the government. But also, thank you also to Mollman to have given us a little bit hope to show us that, you know, the international community actually has some best intention. The new those resolutions that have been adopted, and the recent one that I think we hope will have at least a special representative of the Secretary General on gender issue. We hope it will be someone who knows, who really understands, and who has the courage and the willingness to change certain things. And also, thank you so much for also highlighting how the disparity between gender and equality led to violence against women. So this said, he doesn't mean that even though we have this best or this good this best intentions by the international community, that we have actually reached what we needed. So now, why there is still this failure in prevention? Why these best intentions are not being materialized and concretized in seeing concrete results in stopping, ending this violence against women? That's why I now invite Ms. Kelly Model. Am I pronouncing
you
well?
You are. Very few people do, but that was correct.
Ms. Kelly is the gender specialist with the International Center for Transitional Justice, where she's been with ICTJ since 2001. She worked on Sierra Leone, and also she actually conducted some studies on the field of how the transitional justice mechanism have addressed or failed to address the targeting of sexual minorities during the period of conflict. She has an MA in international political economy and the development with a concentration in development study from Fordham University. Please, have the floor.
Thank you. Bekenny asked me to speak about the SADC protocol that Kuda mentioned, but then also to speak a little bit to the Nairobi Declaration. And so I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to sort of go on a tangent about past abuses and how they relate to current abuses and all that. But let's start with SADC. And just to say that a lot of the views that I'll be expressing in this come from a workshop that we held in August in Cape Town, where we brought women activists from Southern Africa together to talk about the impunity gap that is going on right now, and to look at what they felt the priorities were and how connected they felt past violence was to ongoing violence today and where their justice concerns were. So a lot of the things I'll be expressing come out of the conclusions from that workshop, and the report will eventually be released. So as was mentioned before by my colleague, the Southern Africa Development Community signed its protocol in 2008, and this was after 3 years of intense negotiations, and in many ways was considered a huge milestone because it was a fairly groundbreaking commitment to gender equality and was hopefully going to put it at the forefront of SADC's action plan. And some things that were included in there were the sort of objectives were to empower women, to harmonize the regional and international instruments that these countries had signed on to with their national laws, and to also provide a system to set targets by what these countries were supposed to accomplish by 2015, and in a way to evaluate those. So some of these like these targets for evaluation were that 50% of women should be represented in all government offices by that date, that discriminatory laws that existed in both customary law and more formal law should be modified and changed, and that there should be education policies on gender-based violence. And there was a whole section, as was mentioned before, on dealing with gender-based violence. And so by 2015, the protocol calls for governments to prohibit all forms of gender-based violence, that the target they're supposed to reach is to decrease the cases of gender-based violence in half, and that they called for the trials of perpetrators on all forms of gender-based violence before competent courts of justice. So pretty lofty, very good, but huge milestones to be reached. Along with this, SADC has a tribunal, which was inaugurated in November 2005. And the point of the tribunal, its jurisdiction is disputes between member states of SADC, but also between individuals and member states when they've exhausted all other forms of legal redress. Now, I'm not going to talk much about the tribunal, but just to say that, like many of these bodies, it's only as strong as its member states will allow it to be. So the two cases that have come up recently in Zimbabwe looking at abuses that have occurred, one has been ruled on, and it was a farmer who ruled about his lands that had been seized and the violations that took place during that. And the tribunal ruled in favor of him, and Zimbabwe has ignored the ruling and has not provided the compensation that it was required. So in a lot of these things, you'll see on paper things look great. But when it actually comes down to it, if the member states don't have the will to follow these, it's not going to happen. And so, you know, what are sort of the skeptical issues around SADC? Because I think the protocol is very good, but as has been mentioned by my colleagues on this panel, that quite often what you have in paper, there's a huge gap between the reality of what women's lives like are on the ground and how these laws affect them. And this is not just SADC, it's a, you know, national legislations, because the states in Southern Africa, many of them have quite progressive national legislations protecting women in terms of family law, inheritance law, laws regulating divorce and land ownership. But these targeted communities of these laws aren't actually being affected by them. And there is this gap that exists. Another example of that is, you know, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of Security Council 1325. We're still struggling to get women at peace negotiation tables. This is something that in the SADC protocol is called for, that women should play an equal role in peace building and peace negotiations. And in Zimbabwe, women were largely marginalized from being at the table. So this is a constant struggle of what's going on. One of the problems, I think, is that either rights are being on the ground, when you look at actually implementing this, rights are being ignored or misunderstood. So, you know, in Mozambique, there's gender-sensitive legislation around this family law. It's very, very progressive, but yet violence and domestic violence against women, women not being able to actually inherit the land they're supposed to inherit, is still ongoing. And I think in part this is because a lot of this is going on where formal structures of law don't reach. And so it's in rural areas where customary law still in some ways trumps these formal structures. And the formal structures that do exist in those areas are weak. Second, if you look at the case, and I think South Africa is a really fascinating case to look at in the Southern Africa region, because in many ways, you know, on paper, they've done all these things right. You know, they had the Comprehensive Truth Commission to look at abuses under apartheid. They have, you know, one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. And yet violence against women has skyrocketed. And violence against women in terms of one of the new phenomena, or what people are calling a new phenomena, is the issue of corrective rape against lesbians. So gangs of men who openly, quite publicly in townships, rape and beat women who are accused of being lesbians with the guise that, well, this will fix them. Now, this is something that happened under apartheid in the townships, but very few people talk about it. It wasn't something that was recorded by the Truth Commission, and it was very silenced. And if you talk to activists in South Africa, I was there doing research a year ago around this issue of corrective rape and the discrimination against LGBT groups in under the apartheid regime, and they were saying that they really felt the government, they stopped short because they have this progressive constitution, but they never really took it to the people to say, these are what your rights are, mm-hmm. and never translated it into accessible language for them. And so she's like, you know, you go into the townships and you talk to these people, and they don't actually know that they have the right that this shouldn't happen to them, and they have legal recourse. And so I think that a lot of times these things sort of get stuck. You know, they're there in paper, but then because of resources or moving on to other things or because of political will, governments don't then actually do a good job of working with civil society to make sure that people know their rights. For SADC itself, one thing that women's groups sort of discussed a lot at this regional workshop was that in many ways they feel like it's still an old boys' club. So it's a lot of times it's formed by, you know, in the Southern Africa region, you have a lot of liberation movements that have created sort of one-party states when they came to power. A lot of them trained together, they've financed one another, and now they sit in SADC together. And so the result of this is often, during the liberation movements, women's issues often took a back seat, even though women were incredibly involved in these movements. I mean, in Namibia, they received training. Even if they served as only cooks and porters, they still received basic military training. Angola, Mozambique, women fought alongside men. And then when it came to this period of liberation, the men said, well, that's all well and good. You played this equal role. But, you know, we have other priorities that we need to deal with in this independence period. And so gender issues sort of got shifted. So I think a lot of women, you know, are aware that these issues become subordinate. And to some extent, women, if you look at the South African TRC report, women also subordinate these issues themselves out of loyalty to the party. So there were ANC, the African National Congress, which was the main liberation party in South Africa. There were training camps in, I believe, Mozambique, Namibia, and Angola. And there are, it's well known that many of the women fighting in the ANC were raped by their fellow soldiers. But they never reported it during the Truth Commission process because they didn't want to give the ANC a bad name. And it was seen that party loyalty, you know, comes first and the struggle against the apartheid government comes first. So, you know, and then just another quick example, if you look in Namibia, the main party there, SWAPO, has done a pretty good job of controlling sort of the historical record of the independence struggle. And so there are a lot of women who expressed at this workshop that, you know, there were abuses committed by SWAPO, but that will never come to light. It's been buried so far. So I think there's a sense that these leaders often sort of, they have, you know, they've had this common set of goals, they've been through these experiences together, and they often protect one another. And if gender issues or sexual violence or women's groups threaten that, they're going to sort of shut down and pull in. So I would, moving on sort of from SADC, I would argue that I think, you know, and that's not that we shouldn't celebrate the protocol and the protocol isn't a good thing. I think it's a matter of being really vigilant and pushing leaders to, you know, actually act on the political will that's needed for what they signed on to. It's, you know, supporting women's groups to continue to do advocacy around the protocol. But I think it'd be good to look a little broader as to how we could deal with these issues. And some things the women in this regional workshop expressed was that, and this was very well laid out actually in Kuda's presentation, is that, you know, this violence isn't a new thing. It's something that's, you know, been around since colonialism, since, you know, the early liberation struggles. And in a lot of states outside of, in Southern Africa, besides South Africa, it's never actually been dealt with. And so a lot of these women were arguing that, you know, by not providing justice for violations, essentially you've sent the clear message over these decades that they're okay. It's okay to do this. And they very much linked it to the sort of pervasiveness of this belief that impunity for sexual violence is the way it is. It's a byproduct of war, or it's a domestic issue that doesn't need to be dealt with and shouldn't be dealt with. And so it kind of perpetuates this whole idea. And just to talk briefly about Namibia again, South Africa, the Namibian forces, there was a group of Namibian forces who fought for South Africa, and the acronym is SWAFT, Southwest African Troops. And in order to divide and conquer the Namibian people, the South African forces their sort of campaign was to order these soldiers who were Namibian to rape other Namibian women. And the idea was to sow this discontent within society. And the women brought this up, how this has never been really openly discussed. There's never been any sort of prosecutions for it. There's never been any sort of truth and accountability for it in any way. And activists very much link this to the ongoing violence against women today. And one of the groups that was there had done a study, it's the Legal Assistance Center in Namibian, where over 40% of Namibian men think it's justifiable to beat their wife. This is sort of, you know, it's an okay practice. And 32% of women also think it's okay. And so the women at this conference were making this link that, you know, we haven't dealt with past violations, and this has a huge impact on the ongoing impunity today. They're not separate issues. So, and just to actually touch briefly, because one of the things, you know, a lot of the sort of, and I think Mozambique's a really interesting example, because there are a lot of people who will claim, you know, they didn't do traditional transitional justice, you know, measures. They didn't have a truth seeking, they didn't have trials, and they've reconciled. And it's actually a really fascinating case study, I think. But a lot of these countries did do some reintegration of ex-combatants, but they relied on the customary traditional community measures, which were then often, and I don't want to hesitate to say that they're always discriminatory against women, because I don't think that's the case. I think there's needs to be a lot more work done on this. But they are often discriminatory against women. And so representatives from Angola said, you know, one of the ways to reintegrate combatants into the community was to marry a combatant to a woman in the community. But these were often ex-combatants who had pillaged and burned these communities and sometimes raped these specific women. And so these traditional methods of reconciliation alienated women even further, and in many cases re-traumatized them. So I think one of the findings of the conference is that there is this growing sort of desire in that region to look at those past abuses. And obviously in the case of Zimbabwe, the past is not that long ago and is still ongoing in many ways. But in other countries where the transitions have taken place a little bit further, or the conflicts are considered, you know, to have happened a little, there's been more time, there's still this very much this need. People are calling for this examination in order to deal with current abuses. And so this is where the Nairobi Declaration comes in my presentation. Because I think it's a declaration about reparations. It's a group of civil society activists who mobilized to essentially redefine the right to reparation, or to look at it through a gendered lens. And I think it's incredibly progressive, and it's an incredibly interesting document. Because so reparations within the transitional justice framework, they're in many ways the mechanism that directly affects victims the most. So where prosecutions can be somewhat removed from victims, even truth-seeking can be somewhat removed from victims, reparations, you know, look to redress the harm that victims suffered. So there are, in some ways, a more direct link to these victims. And the way, you know, sort of the theoretical concept behind reparations is that they restore women as equal rights placeholders in society, or, you know, the victims as equal rights placeholders, and repair the harm. But the Nairobi Declaration looks at, you know, it's, if you're restoring women to the status quo of where they were before the harm took place, you're essentially returning them to lives of violence and discrimination. You're not doing any favors to them. And so what the declaration called for was, and I quote, "Reparations must go above and beyond the immediate reasons and consequences of the crimes and violations. They must aim to address the political and structural inequalities that negatively shape women's and girls' lives." And so the declaration that came out from these civil society activists pushed this issue of reparations to say, you know, it can't be about the violation itself, but it really has to look at the structural inequalities that have made women vulnerable to these violations. And in this way, albeit a modest one, because reparations are, you know, are very confined by resources and a lot of demands, it can help empower women and build women's lives. So just a few examples about how maybe this can happen in concrete terms. If you look at the Moroccan Truth Commission, there was a compensation strategy that happened a few years before the reparations program coming out of the Truth Commission. And that compensation strategy drew on inheritance law, which said that if the husband had died, the majority of the wealth went to the eldest son and the wife didn't receive it. And so the IER, the Truth Commission, recognized this and realized that this was not fair. And so in their recommendation platform, they realigned that so that the children would receive some reparations, but the majority of it went to the wives. And so they challenged those discriminatory practices that existed in society. If you look at Timor-Leste, it's the reparations program hasn't been put into effect because largely a lack of resources and political will in the government. But what they suggested there was, you know, we have a limited amount of resources. Let's prioritize those who are most vulnerable. And that included widows and victims of sexual violence. And because they were most vulnerable, what they did was they said, we need to give them something to help rebuild their lives, because they were the hardest hit by the consequences of these violations. And so they prioritized them for things like skills training and microcredit programs. And then finally, another sort of novelty that came out of the Timor program was that a suggestion that for community reparations, there be actually community education programs for men and for families and communities to explain sexual violence, how vast it was, and to try to then, in that way, reduce the stigma for women who tried to return to their communities after the conflict. So I think the Nairobi Declaration really opens up the door in some ways for creative ways of looking at the violence that's going on, how it's linked to the past, and what can be done to maybe overcome that. So I'm out of time, so I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Kaylee, for that. Yeah, thank you so much, Willie, for giving us an analysis of how some transitional mechanisms have worked throughout Africa. You touched about Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, how, for example, the Nairobi Declaration with regard to reparation works, and also the consequences of not implementing those justice instruments that are being adopted by countries with regard to the SADC gender protocol, which is kind of a very young protocol. But here is my concern. We have heard with regard to Zimbabwe and ongoing violence against women. We have heard what kind of causes that, you know, that leads to this violence. And we have heard about some mechanisms, you know, those transitional mechanisms and justice mechanisms, which are not very effective sometimes, and which, you know, kind of, you know, shows kind of a gap between what is being adopted and what should be done concretely to protect these women. And that is the problem we still face right now. We have a situation where the fact that the violence is ongoing, there is a kind of a show of kind of efforts that are being made to try to kind of address the situation, but we are not getting there, and these women are continuing suffering. So why this is happening, even though we have the power, the capacity to bring this change in general? This is one of the, my biggest concern that they have. So on that note, I will now open for Q&A. I think we have heard a lot from Zimbabwe to the region and throughout the transitional mechanisms and also other justice instruments throughout the continent. So if you have any question, please, you have the mic there. You have just raised your hand, and then I will point to you, and then you're going to ask your question. But before we move on to that, I have to tell you that, you know, I have been told to announce that this event is being recorded. Yes. Please, when you want to ask a question, please, can you just tell us your name and the organization you work for?
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Sharon Doctor. I'm from a Pyramid Health Network, a nonprofit that focuses on HIV/AIDS. And the question I had is for Marianne. Earlier in your lecture, you stated that based on the patterns and the trends, we can basically predict when another uprising will occur. So my question is, in those cases, if we can predict an uprising, what, you know, is there like a campaign or what type of interventions are done to try to procure that? I mean, sometimes we can't prevent everything, but what is being done in terms of prevention? Well, if you can give any recommendations, that would be great. Thank you.
This next one. No, let's take kind of a three in a row, and then you know. Yes, please.
Hi, Betsy Apple from AIDS Free World. A quick comment and then a question. My comment is that I think when we talk about, we're not necessarily talking about rape and conflict when we talk about Zimbabwe. And I think it's very important to distinguish rape as a weapon of war from rape as a political tool. I just want to sort of put that out there because I don't know that I heard that distinction being made so much, maybe a little bit by CUDA. I think the other piece of that is that I think in our research, we're about to put out a report about rape and politically motivated rape in Zimbabwe. What we found is that many, many women were raped because of their own political activities and their own political affiliation, not simply because of their connection to men who are political, and I think that's an important point to make as well. My question is this. As folks probably know, Zimbabwe has recently rejected or repudiated the SADC Tribunal and has claimed that the SADC Tribunal is an illegitimate institution that has no jurisdiction over any of the SADC members. So how, and SADC has been silent on Zimbabwe's rejection. So I'm curious to know how CUDA in particular, but also the other panelists as well, how one addresses this problem of the legitimacy of the institution being undermined by one of the main perpetrators of the violations and how that gets integrated into campaigns like this. Thank you.
The other question? Respond to these two. The first is for Ms. Mummelman, who is being asked, you know, what should be done to prevent these violations?
Yes, I'm sure that I have as much as an idea as other people in answering this question. The way I heard it is, if we know how conflicts are going to surge, why are they not being prevented? And from my vantage point, I work in New York. I work a lot with the Security Council, advocating with Security Council members and other parts of the UN. There's a real reluctance to get involved at all, even when it's very clear that conflict has arisen. There are many, many situations where we can't get the Security Council to take any action, the Security Council being the only place in the UN where there is some sort of possibility to send in peacekeepers or to do something to move action. So if we cannot get the Security Council to get into preventive mode where it's clear that a lot of violence is already happening and a lot of violence will continue to happen unless they do something, it's unlikely that we'll be able to get them to do it where violence is still very private, quote unquote. You know, it's street violence, as it were. That being said, for me, the concept of responsibility to protect, which is a wide concept, you know, it arose now almost 10 years ago, and it deals with the. It doesn't say anything new. Basically, it says the nation state has primary responsibility to prevent violence happening towards its citizens or being committed towards its citizens, and when they can't do that, under Chapter 7 authority, the Security Council can get involved. This was the case before. You know, some people talk about responsibility to protect as a new legal development. It's not. This is just restating what was before. The Security Council at the moment refuses to talk about responsibility to protect. This is a dirty concept, as it were. But from my perspective, all the action has been on the back end of this. Responsibility to protect when we already know that violence is happening. And it seems to me that there is a lot of work that could be done academically or outside of the UN regime to develop all of these indicators or early warning systems, et cetera, to work on the back end of responsibility protect and to make sure that that's a much more solid concept. When I say there's research out there, there's not massive research, but there's certainly enough that it took me a week to go through it when I went through it. You know, that's not a lot of research. There's a much, much more research on the back, you know, sort of what we see when conflict has already arisen. So yeah. I think that there's a lot of work to be done on the back end of the responsibility to protect concept and to make it legitimate again, I think, would be to sort of show its its effectiveness in preventing conflict, and there, you know, that's a cost-benefit analysis. Wouldn't it be better if we could just prevent all of this, even in terms of, you know, spending the money on the military? Though I guess some people have interest in that. So that's my answer. It's a bit of a rambling answer and probably not as concrete as you wanted it to be.
And the next question was, you know, we have the SADC tribunal, and many countries out there, even though they have ratified or signed the agreement on the SADC tribunal, but still they are refuting the legitimacy of the SADC tribunal. How do you think we're going to be effective in adopting something and then at the end refute its legitimacy? What's the problem with there? Because so everyone on this panel can just jump on. Kukuda, you want to go first?
Yeah, I don't have an answer. I don't, because as you know, the SADC Troika met on the 5th, which was last Thursday, to discuss the issue of Zimbabwe. They didn't say anything about the SADC tribunal. There's nothing. I've got the communique here. They're actually congratulating the inclusive government for peace and stability in the country, regardless of all that is going on. The only thing that I can suggest that we do as part of our campaigns is to engage with the MDC, because they are the only ones that can actually bring it up, because us as civil society, we're not in a position to do that. We hardly get a chance to interact with the SADC tribunal as it is, I mean, not the tribunal, with the summit. So they don't give us an opportunity to come with our issues and discuss what are the things that we want brought up. So besides engaging the MDC and asking them to bring it up, because when they report to the summit, this is one of the issues that they should raise, but they didn't raise it. Yeah.
I don't have an answer either, but I'd be interested to hear, because you do advocacy work, like what your, if you have, yeah.
I don't have an answer either, and certainly not on Zimbabwe. And I know that, you know, Betsy and everybody else at AIDS Free World has much more in-depth knowledge on Zimbabwe than I certainly do. So on the specific issue, I can't comment. I can say that this is not the first time that the directly affected people are saying, you know, we don't believe in the legitimacy of this court or this international justice system, ICT, exactly. Well, no, I wasn't thinking of the ICC. I was thinking of the tribunal on the former Yugoslavia. You know, there were obviously very known cases of this rejection even during the trial of Milosevic. And so I think there are ways to overcome it. In the case of the SADC tribunal, though, the problem that you're running into is that there is sort of a sort of closing rank of this, as everybody knows here, the Southern African Development Community, the countries there, and this is something we're dealing with at the Security Council, to get African countries to speak out against African countries is very hard at the sort of diplomatic level. I think that where we've had some success on other issues with getting, you know, breaking that rank is to really develop very good communication strategies between civil society in that country and civil society outside, having a press strategy that involves, you know, taking whatever happens in New York and bringing it back to whatever the country, or whatever happens in Geneva, bring it back, or cross-fertilizing that. Often governments and their diplomatic missions will think they can do whatever outside of their country and nobody's going to, you know, think about that. Some of the messaging that can have to do with, you know, these are people just like you that are being, you know, raped or targeted, et cetera. This is somebody in a government is saying that it's okay for somebody just like you to be violated, et cetera. But I think that the answer is in breaking that rank. And I don't know how to do that effectively.
Yeah. It seems like your question actually doesn't have, you know, the right answer at the moment. Maybe it's going to be a kind of, I don't know, homework. We're going to wake her home. But do you have an idea how we can deal with the maybe how we can deal with the enforcement of SADC tribunal's decision?
Yeah, I have the answer, and this was just a test.
Awesome.
Sorry.
Okay.
No, actually, I do. I had a follow-up comment, which is, it's not the answer, but it's related to that, which is, folks may or may not know that with respect to what happened in Guinea, ECOWAS, which is the West African economic grouping, actually came together and took action by instituting sanctions and an arms embargo against that country, in part because of the rape, the sexual violence. And I think it's a very I'm curious to know if folks have thoughts about why it happened in West Africa there, and why the regional grouping felt empowered to actually take action versus why it's not happening in SADC. Now, I think there's obviously a different political context, liberation movements, the history, that all makes something of a difference. But there is an instructive, there is that example of West Africa, so we see that it can happen for regional groupings to take action against their brethren, if you will. And I'm curious to know, you know, and that seems inspiring and helpful to me in thinking about SADC, but I just, that's not the answer, it's just food for thought.
Right, thank you so much for that example. We kind of still have time. Do we think that, you know, the example with the ECOWAS can be applied into SADC context?
I think it is hopeful. I think that it's a very different political context. The, you know, presence of South Africa in the SADC is whatever it is. One of the things that I think is instructive of the ECOWAS taking action on Guinea situation is that both the EU and the UN Security Council took their time, and, you know, there's sort of a little bit of the, you know, if you're sitting on the outside, sort of dragging their feet, but what they were doing was allowing ECOWAS to hold that legitimacy. They were pushing, but they weren't being so public about, well, if you don't do this, then we'll take action. I mean, that's obviously what they were saying. And, you know, in the end, there was a coming together. But I think that that's helpful, saying you're dealing with, you know, we're allowing you, quote unquote, to deal with your issue as long as you do it effectively. And I think that that was helpful. Mm-hmm. I don't think that, that's been tried in SADC, and that doesn't help there. So,
My understanding is that the DRC is now the chair of SADC. And someone can correct me, but my colleague in South Africa told me that Mugabe had bankrolled Kabila's election campaign, and I don't know if that's entirely accurate, but I think there are those you know, connections that exist that keep them from acting upon one another based upon wealth, and, you know, and it may be a different situation, so it's a cynical one, but it's
yeah. As someone from the Congo, I understand. You know, you have a situation of the father and the son. So how can you send Joseph Kabila to go and pressure Mugabe? That's, yeah. You know, it just doesn't work. But to that question, you know, how that ECOWAS example can be applied onto SADC region, it's very complicated. Part of the reason is because when you look at the West Africa, they still have these kind of strong ties with France. France as the colonial kind of country. So when you have those kind of issues in the West Africa, you have a kind of very strong influence of France. And one of, if I'm sure you might know this, one of the reason why these sanctions against Guinea were adopted is because of France was really heavily behind and really asked those countries to come together to really condemn that and what they did. So when you look at the Southern Africa, which is now SADC, that's where the problem is. You have you have for example Mozambique and Angola. They have their own colonialists. You have the Congo, have the Belgian, and you have actually British with Zimbabwe and everybody else. So to have them come together and have pressure, it will require really, you know, many things. That, I think, part of the reason, that's part of the reason why the situation in the West Africa, it will be difficult to be applied in the Southern region, but not impossible. If these three or four colonialist countries come together, say, we can do something about this, there is something that really can be done. So that's just my little answer to that. Can we?
I agree with what you've said, Bukeni. The problem with Southern Africa, We all had hopes when Jacob Zuma was campaigning. He said, oh, Zimbabwe will be resolved within the next 3 weeks, or we know with him coming into power. Now that he is in power, he's part of SADC, he's gone completely quiet on the Zimbabwe issue. So we really don't understand what it is about Mugabe that nobody will slap his wrist. Every time he does something, you know, we have all this optimism that, yes, SADC is going to do something, you know, to stop Mugabe in what he's doing. But they never do. They never, never do. And we really, we don't understand what it is. And we're actually afraid that now that the MDC is part of the inclusive government, they're being sucked into that as well. So I don't know. I don't think the ECOWAS method will work in Zimbabwe until we understand what it is about SADC and their relationship with Mugabe. Yeah.
Next. Yes, I have Violetta and I have Miss there or whoever can come. Please come. Come forward. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. My name is Nasuzika Kembo and I'm in the Office of Programs here at OSI. And I'm wondering if you feel that in the influence in terms of the urgent response to the situation, the recent situation in Guinea and in West Africa in general, if the gender composition of ECOWAS and other regional institutions had any influence in the urgency as compared to SADC, and more, I guess, more related, if you even believe down to the level of Ellen Sirleaf Johnson in her presence and in her role as a head of state, and female, obviously, if you feel that had a tremendous influence in the model of the ECOWAS response as compared to SADC and the representation of gender in that regional body. Thank you.
Next question. Yes, Violeta.
Violeta Krasnich from Witness Kuda. I'm fearing that this is going to be another question with no answer or at least a very brief one, but at least for a moment, I want us to go back to women survivors of violence. Mm-hmm. If you could please tell us about any advocacy existing or needed advocacy efforts to address the trauma and to work with women in the communities, especially if there is anything in terms of self-organizing. I come from former Yugoslavia, and uh-huh. I work with women war rape survivors, uh-huh. so self-organizing efforts were uh-huh. very essential in the process. Uh-huh. And going back to this connection between civil societies, you know, in the region and across, what are the actions, what are the steps needed to address the trauma and to help the healing? Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
On that note of the actions to address trauma and healing, you had mentioned, Kelly, that we need to get a good education program rolling. In all these different countries, and I am wondering, this is kind of off subject, but I would like to know if anyone has any experience of a program in this country for teenagers, for young women and young men, to discuss these kind of issues and to take an active participation in coming from particularly our society where we are blessed to have so many freedoms, to use this as a tool to create advocates among teens. To be out there in the world working, so it's much more obviously a much more on the surface simple question, but
there we go.
Okay, so we have four questions. The first one, which is you know addressed to all of us here, is the gender composition in ECOWAS had an influence in the with regard to the solution that happened in the case of Guinea?
Well, this round of questions is really easy for me because I don't have an answer on any of them. On the gender composition of ECOWAS, I have to say I never really thought of it. And personally, I've always thought of, you know, the need for women's representation wherever, equal representation, and the furthering of women's issues as relatively separate. I think there are two different issues. You know, some women have absolutely no gender consciousness, and some men are very good advocates for gender equality. That said, you know, sometimes you see women who are dealing on a daily basis with, for example, children as very much understanding of what it means to have the burden of that responsibility. And so they become better sort of automatic advocates for that. So that happens, just saying. But generally for me, they're two separate issues. So I have no idea on that. On the two other questions or three, I really don't know. With teenagers and making them advocates in this country, I would really encourage people to advocate for prevention of sexual violence where they are. Because I think we have much more legitimacy, you know, from wherever they are. And teenagers here will have a lot of legitimacy in talking about date rape and date violence, which is enormous in this country. So I'm just putting it out there. I don't know what the programs are, but that's what I would suggest.
Yes, please, go ahead.
On ECOWAS, I mean, I agree with Mariana that I think that, you know, this is the favorite thing to do, is we say, oh, there are 5 women out of 15, so therefore we've done our work. And quite often it doesn't translate into any sort of gender, you know. It doesn't translate into pushing gender issues at all. But I know that, and I'm not sure how this happened, but I know that in the terms of reference for the Commission of Inquiry to Ghana, it included reference to gender and trying to look into the sexual violence and to having gender expertise. And so they have one person as part of that 3-person Commission of Inquiry does have a gender background. And so that is, I think, it's a good advancement in terms of how the UN works and how they tend to deploy commissions of inquiry. And but it was an requirement that the DPA was looking for. So, there you go.
It happened because we asked for it. Not Human Rights Watch, but a number of people were asking.
Yeah, and I know that even after it was in there was still some struggle to get names together and to get DPA to actually look at them. On the education programs, if you give me your card, I can actually get back to you on this, because something that's come up recently that people at ICJ have been talking about is, I guess there's a phenomena about using different media, particularly, and I feel a little hesitant about this idea, but I've been told that it works, video games, to try and get youth, North American youth, sort of engaged in these ideas of global conflict and victims. And to me, it feels a little bit like a slippery slope in terms of, you know, how that's done. But I've heard that it's been successful, and there are models out there that are very good and don't actually, you know, contribute to maybe how people perceive violence as being normal. But so if you give me your card, I can talk to my colleagues and put you in touch with them, and they can give you the names of some groups working on that.
Yes, and we have two questions here we haven't really responded. It's about the trauma. Did you have you worked before with the survivors of trauma to try to see how, for example, we can initiate some healings practices? And also, with regard to the youth, I think you are from ANAP campaign, no?
Sorry?
Are you from the same organization with Jimmy?
No.
Oh. Okay, good. So, do you think this is something we can try to see if this may be a way of people can try to, you know, push and see how it can work in order to kind of help, you know, address some issues locally, not just, you know, sit down and wait for the UN or for SADC. What can the youth do, for example? Do you have an idea?
Well, I think I'm going to address the issue on trauma first. They aren't a lot of organizations dealing with trauma in Zimbabwe, but there is one organization called the Tree of Life, which is an organization that is offering a space for victims to talk about what happened to them. This process, it's for healing and empowerment. Just it gives, and it's not necessarily for women, but for all victims in the Zimbabwean context, to sit down and talk about what happened to them, because a lot of them, this is the first time they've actually opened up and said something about what happened to them. This has, I think it started about two years or so, but it's received very little support, so they're not able to go out into the community and make an impact. However, this year they have made a lot of inroads within areas that were considered no-go areas within Zimbabwe in Mrewa and Mutoko, which are strong ZANU-PF areas. The political leaders in those areas have said, come in and talk to the people here because there's a lot of trauma. But as I said, they haven't received a lot of support and they can't do as much as they can. And this is not, they're not trained psychologists, the people that are running these programs. It's just people who came together and said, let's give victims a space to talk. So there are very few organizations that are dealing with psychological support, psychosocial support for victims in Zimbabwe. There is the Counseling Services Unit, which provides mainly medical assistance. There's also the Association of Doctors for Human Rights, but again, that's more medical rather than counseling. Yeah, there are other smaller NGOs that have started to do counseling, like Connect, and I think Childline is also offering some sort of trauma healing for these victims, but it's at a very, very low level. So a lot more needs to be done. And that's one area in Zimbabwe that we've been saying, let's give these people support. Let's find support for these kinds of programs, because if these people live with the trauma that they have lived with over the past few years, it's only just going to make the situation worse if there is, I mean, during the next election period, which we know is coming soon, and they're likely to be re-traumatized anyway. So something really needs to be done about that.
We still have like 5 minutes. Yes. Maybe the last round of questions.
So this isn't actually a question, but I just wanted to, there are a few of us here from an organization called the Man Up Campaign, which is a new initiative to mobilize young leaders in 50 countries, just as you said, addressing the issue of violence against women in their communities as relevant to those communities. And we're also developing out an education piece. So if anyone wants to talk about that more, I'm here, Jimmy, Gabrielle, Jessica. We'd love to. It's all about coalition and about working together to address these issues as relevant in communities. So we're happy to talk to you.
Okay. Question? Last round? Okay. Seems like. Oh, yes, sir.
My name is Michael DeBenny. I have a query about any information or commentary you have about the immigration and refugee camps, especially around the Congo area, and some of the justice issues that might be going on inside or dealing with some of the neighboring countries. Thanks.
Any? Oh, do we have any other one? No questions. Anybody has another question? No. Okay. Who's gonna jump on that?
I'm gonna pass on those questions. I'm going to pass because I don't know, but I would want to just echo, I really encourage everybody to look up the initiative Man Up. It's a great initiative and involving engaging men and women together on the issue of violence against women, which I think hasn't happened very much. It's been all women together, all men together, well, mostly all women. So this is a wonderful initiative.
The only thing I could say is probably what everyone reads in the papers, which is that, particularly in the Eastern DRC and outside of that, that there's just horrific levels of sexual violence going on, both by rebel groups and also by police. And then I know that there are some initiatives, one taken by OSI, to do mobile courts that are going around to try perpetrators. But I don't know much more than that. And I don't know, actually, Bukenny, if you would know.
Well, I'm going to pass. Maybe Kuda, you have an idea? No.
No idea what's going on in the
DRC. Okay. I think I have a moral responsibility to respond that question because I'm from the Congo, actually. Yes, there. You know the issue of IDPs and refugees in the Congo and also outside the Congo, but there has not been any process in terms of justice in within the camps or within these IDPs or refugee camps. Most of them are in Tanzania, in Burundi, in Uganda, in Sudan, in Congo Brazzaville, and also in Zambia and Angola. But the recent situation, I know everyone will look at the East, but the most tangible situation which is going on now is in the West. Those returnees from Angola are being returned by force by Angola to return to the Congo. And while there, because the situation is very political, they are demanding actually the Congo to initiate or to open a case against the state of Angola, because these people lost everything when they were being evacuated from Angola. That's one. And second, with regard to those returnees who are now going back to Rwanda, those FDLR, it's been said that, you know, not all of them are the former genociders, as we know. So some of them are being returned in their country. But the problem is that they have lost everything. So they are trying to kind of to demand either restitution or any compensation, because they have been forced to leave the country. That's one. But the problem is, since you have that kind of picture of being from a group that is so-called genocidal, those interahamwe, it's not easy to be heard. And the third, as those returnees from Tanzania who are coming from Tanzania to South Kivu in the Congo. Now, the UNHCR, their office in Uvira and in South Kivu, has initiated a campaign an identification process to identify what kind of properties these refugees had before and see how the government of the Congo can help to retake those properties that these refugees have left when they were running away. So this is the kind of picture what is happening now. So it is a situation which is very, very, very confusing. Why? Because the Congo is saying we don't have enough resources on this. And second is about what is their priority. They are looking at peace because they have initiated what they called an operation called Kimia 2, or Kimia 2, which is, you know, try to kind of, you know, to fight those, you know, negative forces. And in these operations, you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of IDPs almost in every area where these operations are going on. Second, the Avocat Sans Frontières has initiated what they call the mobile court. Since 2005, they have not been very successful part of it, because they don't have, you know, enforcement mechanisms. They initiated that, but who will now enforce any decision that will be made by this court will be the government. While the government itself is not a stable government, and the justice hasn't been seen as one of the priority that the government has, not just because they cooperate well with the ICC, but they still have other issues with regard to Bosco Ntaganda, who everyone is demanding to be handled to the ICC. So you have a situation where there are some cases, but there has not been really a concrete case where they can say there is something that is going on. So on that, I think we are on time. I have to thank you so much, and let's say that from this debate, it seems like the work is not finished yet. We have seen here that in Zimbabwe, the situation is just not good because of the political crisis that led to violence against women. We know, all of us, almost in terms of the Congo, the armed conflict which is there has led to millions or hundreds of thousands of women being raped and sexually abused. And other countries, as we have seen in South Africa, in Madagascar, it is still something that is going on. And we know that we have some transitional mechanism and instrument which are going on, but they just don't work. So the question is that even if we're going to wrap up today, I think the issue is how we as civil society, we're going to think more strategically what kind of advocacy can be made to really try to push where a political willing lacks. On that note, I thank you so much, and thank you for your panelists.